Hi, welcome to Leadership Beyond the Trenches. I'm your host, Anne Reifenstein, and today we're going to be talking with Brigadier General Greg Smith. His last position was as the Assistant Chief of Staff, J5 Plans, at Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, Chief Planner for NATO. So we had a great conversation of his perspectives and his ideas and his thoughts about leading in an institutional setting. So I hope you'll enjoy this conversation.
Right. And, you know, and it's a hard sell. It's a hard sell because a lot of people don't have that background. They see it as a managerial thing as opposed to a leadership aspect. So that's
well,
the kind
that's
of thing
actually
I'm trying to...
an interesting point because let me think. In 2012, I led Op Attention Rota 1 as the deputy commander, which means effectively I built this 1,000-person task force, took it over to Afghanistan. The commander was also a NATO or a coalition general. But to talk to mostly officers, but equally senior NCOs and say, okay, you've all just done basic soldier training. But don't forget, you are still leaders and you will be looked at based on the rank on your chest or on your shoulders. I thought I communicated it deliberately, and yet I still had to kick people out, charge people for some very basic soldier stuff that obviously you and I could quickly understand is not acceptable behavior. And I don't know, people lose perspective quite easily. So it's I think what you're doing makes a lot of sense and is very valuable to remind people that you are going to be a leader. And if you choose not to act like one, you're still going to be seen that way based on the rank and your experience.
So do you have like a guiding philosophy or a particular approach that you take towards your own role as a leader?
Well, I go back at, first of all, I agree with your point. Like, we never stop being leaders. And for those of us from time to time that are gifted with actual command, where you have the legal and written authority to do things, that's one. But we remain leaders throughout. And so I think as far as a guiding philosophy goes, I think it's about, number one, we've got work to do. We've got things that we've got to get done. And you as a leader, you're ultimately responsible for that. And that was my job in NATO, both as a Canadian and then as a NATO officer, was just to get stuff done. Because you had to produce a lot of work. And I think that was the credibility, is that NATO people from time to time think it's this fuzzy world that's all cocktail parties, etc. But in the end, you're respected for the work you can get done. And if you can get the work done and bring value to the organization, you're respected and you get some form of positive feedback and indeed influence for that. But so first and foremost, I think it's just about plain and simple organizing your people, being, I hate to say the term, a manager, and effectively use your resources, which in that case include people. But equally, communication. If there's one thing that I think has been reinforced throughout my career, is communication is critical. And not just in NATO, but in any organization, you have to communicate vertically and laterally. You have to communicate to your bosses about what you're doing, what you expect to be doing, and so that they can equally alert their bosses. And if you're not going to be able to achieve the timeline because it was never realistic, you need to be messaging that. And equally down, you have to be communicating to your people constantly of what they're doing, why it's important, why they need to work so hard. But equally, particularly what I did as the Assistant Chief of Staff, J5, in Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, was I had about, let's say, 10 subordinate commands. And these included joint forces commands across Europe. And then single service commands, as we called them, like land and air and SOF and Navy, et cetera. But you had to constantly communicate with them because they equally had their bosses that wanted them to do stuff. But at the same time, you had to give them tasks and they had to say they could support that type of stuff. Further, and this is interesting, particularly in NATO, is the fact that you have to lead and mentor your group. Now, I was very fortunate to have about 45 people that included NATO officers, NATO civilians, interns, volunteers. It was a real mishmash from about 18 different countries. And fortunately, present company excluded, they were all rock stars. They were all really smart, really capable, strategically minded individuals, generally very, very good in English, that came and worked very, very hard. And sometimes you get this legend about, well, you know, we Canadians are really good NATO. And yeah, I'm sure that's true to a certain extent. I wouldn't want us to rest on those laurels too much. But more importantly, where I worked, they were all incredibly capable. And yet, despite that, because they're from a different nation, you're not really responsible for them. And so you write something called an international evaluation report, and you look after them, and you genuinely want to make sure they're doing well, and how are their families. Many of them don't live where they're working, and they have to travel back and forth. But at the same time, as far as that cool stuff of managing their career, making sure they're ready for the next step, you don't really get to do that, which I found a little bit disconcerting. We would tend to get some very high-level people come visit, and then you get to say a lot of great thing about those people. But at the same time, that usual idea of, here's the people that work for me, I like what they're doing, this is how I'm going to make sure they get to the next step in their career really fast or fast, that just doesn't really work. And it was a really kind of fascinating thing to go through. And I think the last one, and this is a very NATO point, is at the same time, you're Canadian. And so, again, if you choose not to think you're, no, I'm just a NATO officer, well, again, you're wearing the uniform around. And just like saying, well, you know, I'm not really a leader. Well, you're wearing a uniform that shows very clearly that you've worked up the levels to be a leader based on the rank you are. And so you're a Canadian. And how do you represent your country and properly make sure that you're contributing? Because Canada belongs to NATO for many reasons. And we have to justify what we do through cash contribution and capability and people. And we are part of what Canada contributes to NATO. So we need to work hard. We may need to show how we progress things. And that is how we represent Canada. So I think that's sort of a unique aspect of this multinational or NATO-based leadership is, amongst all other things, you're also a Canadian. And so you're a little bit more, you get to write PERs, you get to do certain things like that. And yet at the same time, you realize that you are what your country represents to a lot of these other countries. NATO is now at 30, and 29 other countries look at you and go, oh, so that's what a Canadian is. And I think that's a tremendous responsibility to make sure that you're there, you're working hard. And we Canadians have a few brands, and I think collaboration is perhaps one of them that I actually think is very true. That's how our NATO allies look at us, and you want them to be able to someday turn around and go, I would love to have a young lady, young man from Canada come work for me because I saw how other Canadians did it. And I think that's an added part of the responsibility and how I think about leadership within NATO.
So, sir, is there a tool set or like that sounds really challenging because you know what, it's a step, you know, not being able to take care of your people, like mentoring and supporting them, you know, you're really in a very tight box when you're doing that. So how do you create like an organizational culture with all those disparate nations? You've got, you're leading a team, right? You're leading a team that has to deliver, has mm-hmm. some important deliverables. How do you create a culture or an understanding that alignment with what you're trying to achieve?
It's an interesting question because I've been fortunate enough to work in a lot of, like, so I'm an Army guy, right? I'm an infantry officer. But I've equally spent a bit of time in CANSOF. I went to something called the Defense Renewal Team many years ago, which was a combined military public servant organization, departmental organization. Before I was in Belgium in NATO, I was in Iraq in Baghdad for almost a year with the Americans. And each one of those has a separate culture, and it takes a long time to learn it. And I would say in the case of NATO, it there is a culture there. And so you want, as a leader, build your culture. And I can talk about some of the things you have to start examining the culture you're in and start nudging it. But at the same time, you have to realize NATO, which is now over 70 years old and went from 12 founding nations up to 30, has its own culture. And so you have to learn. And I think anybody that's worked in NATO will say it takes about 6 months to learn about the vocabulary, the organizational culture, the language. I go around and tell people I don't speak English, I speak NATO, because it's a different language. And I was fortunate that I was a national military representative for Canada for the first year. So I kind of dabbled in NATO. I did a lot of Canadian stuff, but I'd hear about NATO things and kind of understand some of it. But when I left this national military representative position to become the head planner for NATO, I would say rather than taking 6 months, it maybe took me three, as I really got into the real guts of what NATO is and trying to fully understand what's there in the culture. And I would say, based on my experience in those different organizations, I'd call myself a cultural chameleon, not to be confused with a karma chameleon, which I know many of the students will start singing in their heads, a cultural chameleon, which means you'll learn about it. Rather, like, I've seen people go in and just be themselves, and the organization just doesn't work that way, and you becomes a bit of a clash of wills as this new leader, and that's usually who it is, insists this is the way things are going to work, versus you have a very mature culture that is just used to doing things. Culture is a funny thing, and we could get into a long discussion about it, but I think it's about what does right look like? What does right look like? When you default to something, how is the right way to do things? And so if you've got a leader that, based on their experience, that's how they do it, and they're not going to bend their ways of thinking to this new, very mature organization, it's going to be a long haul for probably both organizations. Me personally, I found a lot of listening, trying to learn things, because, again, if language is an aspect of culture, if you try to use Canadian Army language in NATO, you're just going to bump into things and say that acronym doesn't mean the same thing, and you're just not going to have effective communication. But with time, you start learning. And so, like I said, it takes about 6 months for you to understand the culture and then try to start nudging it where you need it to be, and try to make it where you want. And again, it's particularly interesting in NATO, where it's got now 30 countries. You have Army, Navy, Air Force, SOF, and other sort of institutional or service cultures that are there. And it just takes time to try to understand it and start influencing it where you need it to go. And I think the biggest thing there is just plain leadership stuff, where you go, you talk to your people, and you learn from them. If you think you're the smartest person in the room because you're the most senior, you very quickly learn you're not. I had, again, some fantastically smart officers that were functioning in their second or third language and yet bringing incredible things. And I learned a lot about strategy there and how the organization that NATO works and how the best way to function in it. There's a lot to be learned. And I would just say any future leaders in a multinational or a coalition organization will have to balance, and it depends on you, how much do you bring your culture and your way of doing things and kind of mess up that organization, and how much do you be the chameleon and slowly leech into the organization and truly understand how it functions, and where's the balance that's right for you.
One of the things that they talk about in Canadian CAF leadership doctrine, they talk a lot about transformational leaderships, and inherent to that is organizational change, right? So we're preparing organizations and working at the strategic level, regardless of where you're working, you're looking to shape the organization, not for next week, but for the next 5-10 years. How do you manage organizational change in a multinational environment? How do you get your head around moving towards that future vision when you have such a disparate group, a different team, if you will?
Yeah, it's about communication, probably about patience. I'll tell you a quick story. This has nothing to do with NATO, but many years ago, I was the aide-de-camp for the Army commander, General Jeffrey, who was a very strategically minded individual. This was 2002, so this is the early days of Afghanistan, and we of course had the 3rd Battalion Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry on the ground in Kandahar, and that earned Canada sort of a place at the table, which meant in realistic terms the Army commander went for some type of conference in Washington and got some time with the United States Army chairman of the United States Army, who was at the time General Eric Shinseki. And so I was involved in some of these different things. And I was very impressed by Shinseki as well. And at some point, there was little Captain Smith talking to General Shinseki. And he said it to me at one point, said, you know, Greg, I'm only here for 4 years. And I said, well, General, 4 years as a commander, that seems like a fairly lengthy amount of time. I think most of us would really look forward to getting 4 years. He went, well, for strategic change, institutional change, 4 years is not enough. You know, there are CEOs out there that get 15 years that fundamentally redirect their institutions. And of course, we military people don't get to do that. But he said, if it's a good enough idea, it will carry on. And I think there's definitely an element of truth to that. But at the same time, you know, we've all read cultural change theory and stuff like that. It's about communication. Communicate. And again, that's even more challenging when you're into a very mature culture. And again, when you're working with different national cultures, like just because you think of things one way, not all countries are the same. Our North American attitude and view of excuse me, security is very different than some of our Eastern European partners or even the Southern partners that look across the Mediterranean, see a very different viewpoint of the world. But communicating constantly and modeling the behavior expecting, it will push the organization forward. Now, again, in cultural change theory, they'll talk about, you know, get your group of leaders or get those that believe in what you're doing and like promote them, etc. Interesting challenge in NATO is that, of course, you don't control the careers of most people. Now, can you say, listen, I am genuinely unhappy with what I'm doing. I can't get there because of this person. Can I move them on? Yeah, okay, you can probably work at that. It's going to be a lot of effort because, again, you have these national military representatives for each of the 30 countries who are usually pretty senior officers, and you go talk to them about, hey, this person isn't working out. You could try that. Or you can just, you know, slow roll and wait the person out until they go away. And I have to admit, I had one thing whereby, I'll tell a quick story about that. Once upon a time, in SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, you have plans and, of course, you have operations. And so planners plan stuff, couple operators plug into that, understand what you're up to, and then slowly it gets transferred over to them, and then it becomes a current operation. That is something all military people will be very well accustomed to. Well, in SHAPE, you of course have some operations that have been going on for years. RSM, which is Resolute Support Mission, as they call it, or Afghanistan, that's been going on since 2001, 2002. So we're talking about a mission that's been going on for 20 years. And so as much as it was planned once upon a time and handed over to our current ops people, there was constantly new types of missions going on, new planning required. So it was a very collaborative situation between the two organizations. And so in one case, one of my branch heads, who's a colonel level, he basically had two bosses. And that can be very difficult. And he was looking for protection and had a very well-known and very strong character in the current ops world that I had to like, I was happy to have him do his thing. And I understood I was supporting him because these were his missions. But I had an important role in it. And I had one colonel that just didn't seem to be able to manage the fact that he thought I should be going toe-to-toe with this guy. He was trying to set up fights for me. And I tried to work with him to say, listen, my team is not J5. My team is NATO. And so the big team winning is the win for me. So I don't want to have a fight with the other guy. If there's something genuinely that, you know, we're fundamentally at odds because it's a bad idea, happy to go and talk to him. But don't set up fights for me, but rather work together. And this colonel just, that culturally was not where he could get. And so after less than a year, he left. And I had a new guy come in who was, by coincidence, a soft guy. And of course, they're perhaps more accustomed to working in a certain degree of ambiguity. And I just had to have a very clear, lengthy discussion with him to say, my team is NATO. My team is not J5. I'm not looking to have my name in lights. I want NATO to progress. And so you're about to have two bosses. And I don't want to fight with him. He doesn't want to fight with me. We actually get along very well. But there's going to be some things where you're going to be at odds with different direction. And if it's genuinely a problem, come see me and we're going to work through it. And this new guy was able to kind of grasp that intent and work both sides. I thought he did a brilliant job of constantly just keeping me informed. Here's what's going on. Me just kind of nodding. That's great. But that was sort of a part of this cultural change that I needed to create within the J5 organization, that we are part of a bigger team. Yeah, we lead on a lot of stuff because you need planners looking forward. But if overall NATO wins, if we are able to produce plans and create better operations and the alliance is more successful, that's the win, not our little organization.
What do you think best prepared you to for that J5 NATO role? Do you think was it like experience or professional development role model of a particular sort?
I think at least two of those points are very true. So number one, education. We have a very good education system in Canada, and that's the formal part of it. But there's, of course, the informal part that you never stop learning. And I hope the listeners out there equally understand that as they complete just JCSP and hopefully move on to NSP and on, your learning can never stop. Somewhere out there, there's a really bad person that probably wants to harm to Canadians. And we have to be better than them. And that means you have now committed yourself to lifelong learning. And I'm a firm believer in that. We were just talking earlier about the latest cool book I'm reading. There are podcasts out there. There's a tremendous amount of information. I was looking for a quote at one point, and somebody once said, you know, military life is so difficult. It takes more than a lifetime to actually learn everything you need. And so I think it's a constant endeavor to try to improve yourself. And so I think it was really interesting, particularly to be the head strategic planner for NATO, because all that cool stuff I've ever done at grad or post-grad or whatever, you actually use. So like, what is deterrence theory? And how does that fit in? And it was something I genuinely would go read a paper on deterrence and go, okay, I've got to think about that because that's where we need to go. And so that constant education, that constant step forward to try to better understand. And I would just say to your listeners, when you're young, you try to be a tactical genius, and good luck if you can get there. And then you move on, and then they send you things like JCSP, and they start kind of throwing this institutional and operational level at you. And hopefully you do lots of learning and you understand jointness better. And so you improve. And then at some point they throw you at NSP. And then you're now really talking about the institution. They're trying to give you the sense that you have to now be the steward of this institution and you have to move it forward. But equally, there is the entire idea of strategy. And what do you do to use all the tools of power of a nation to, largely in our case, protect its security? And all of that, I would say, is our goal as military people. We have to continue to move on and learn that constantly. And I've found that. And therefore, this was sort of the apex of all this, is to be sitting there doing the strategic planning and thinking of all these things and saying, yep, that is actually something I'm going to have to think about. But there's another aspect, which, and I don't want to make it sound like, hey, you get out of jail free on this one. But there is definitely, in a 30-nation alliance, there's a large degree of collaboration. And it perhaps shouldn't have hit me, but NATO works in English. Now, there is a second language of French, which for us Canadians is almost perfect. But there are a lot of people working with you that speak English as a second, third, something like language. I think the most I heard was 8 languages. But that's a unique challenge for them. But if you think it right now, if we had said, no, NATO works in Czech, I can say hello in Czech, and then I'm pretty much done. But fortunately, we Canadians are almost ideal in that sense, that we're one of the 3 countries that speak English as a first language. We could debate who does it better, and we have. But we have an excellent grasp. We have to, so we're naturally, that works very well. We prepared for it all our life. We happen to be in a headquarters where French was what was spoken as the moment you walked outside of the gate. Very handy as well. But we Canadians equally have a culture of collaboration, and some would say because we've lived with many different nationalities for years and allowed that to work together. I actually think it's something that works very well in NATO, whereby I've been involved in meetings where some things that are like some pretty, how should we say, binary statements are met of yes, no, you're dumb, I'm smart. And you just kind of go, whoa, 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 okay, let's just rein that back because we all know where we need to go. And that kind of language isn't helpful, and we're going to get to a solution. And that comes, I think, fairly naturally to many of us Canadians. So there's definitely a degree of you have worked your life to get to that stage where you could be a strategic planner or whatever you're going to do with NATO or any coalition. But at the same time, there are certain inherent things that exist as Canadians that I think that suits us very well to do that.
With the working language of NATO being English, it's a natural advantage. And it actually speaks to a level of privilege that I don't think that we as Canadians really understand, or particularly the Canadian military don't understand how privileged we are within that realm of understanding. We talked earlier, I'm just going to go back to a couple of things we talked about, of stewarding the profession and talking mm-hmm. about being stewards of the profession. I'm just curious as to how you see stewarding the profession.
Okay. No, that's a big question, obviously.
It is. It's a stinker. I've struggled with this a great deal, actually.
It's a stinker, but it's a really good one. And it's one I think senior leaders should be thinking about all the time. Because first and foremost, and I've said this in front of the Army Command and Staff College, we expect you to be a good leader. Like, just off the top, you wouldn't have moved to the level you are if you were a bad leader. We would have found you out and either made sure you never got in contact with people, and there's officers like that, or we'd find a way to have you not in the military anymore. But if you're not a good leader, you don't keep moving up. So that is just, I naturally expect that. Whether you are a unit commander or a leader in a multinational staff somewhere in Belgium, you have to be a good leader, and you wouldn't be there if you weren't. And so the fact that you should be providing good leadership, I would take that as just, that's for granted. You should be able to do that. However, you know, there's equally parts that include the promotion of people. Like, you have to look after your people. And to me, that includes the idea that somewhere walking amongst the ranks of those that you serve may be a future chief of defense staff or a future Canadian Armed Forces chief warrant officer or CPO1. Who knows? And how do you sniff that person out and go, wow, I have got to move you along? And I can say very proudly, and it has nothing to do with me, but I played a very small part in the current Canadian Army chief warrant officer. He was actually one of my company sergeant major once upon a time. I worked with him in the infantry school as a warrant officer. Smart, smart, capable guy. And so I had a very minimal, like, he's the guy that got himself there. But I was at least capable of not getting in his way and not slowing him down, which is perhaps important. But that's part of our job. If you're looking at the institution, you have to sit there and say, so who's going to replace me? Because I'm not going to live forever. And I think it's part of it is being realizing you're mortal. And I'm now 50. And so I'm very clearly feeling mortality to a certain extent. And hopefully everybody is looking at it saying, okay, I'm not going to do this ever or forever. And I've got to pass the torch to somebody. And who's that going to be? And how do I make sure the institution is well served by this person? And so making sure that they're well trained is part of that. And that's what staff colleges are about. But I think one of the things I always think about is from a stewardship perspective is what's your legacy? And I'm not saying anybody's going to build a statue for me or anybody else, heaven forbid. But you have to think about what have you done to contribute to the institution? Because again, we just take for granted, okay, you're gonna be a good leader. You wouldn't be there if you weren't. But after that, what have you done? How have you allowed the institution to improve? Because again, there's a bad person out there somewhere trying to do harm to Canadians. They're trying to get better every day. And how do we make sure that we are getting better faster? And so what are we doing through education? What are we doing by leading better to move the institution forward? And that's sort of what fires me up, is to sit there and say, what is my legacy? Yeah, I'm being a good leader. I better be. But beyond that, what have I done that is kind of moved the institution forward? And one of the things I grasp at occasionally is writing, is putting my ideas down on paper and just going, you know, I'm probably wrong. But even if I'm 5% right, maybe somebody reads this and someday they put that into their leadership rucksack and go, I'm going to use that someday. Or equally look, read the other 95% and go, wow, that was junk. And I am never going to do that. Okay, but that actually, I think, helps the institution, and it helps build that next generation. So those are the things that I think about, and I'm sure there's many other things you should think about when you think about legacy, is that someday they're going to forget your name, but they're going to think about, this is something that got accomplished, and, you know, somebody is standing on your shoulders. And there's a really cool quote that I heard, I think it was on a, it wasn't on a game show, but it was essentially, societies grow great when old people plant trees whose shade they know they will never enjoy. And I've always thought that's a really cool quote, to say that is what building the institution or stewardship is about, is planting those trees, realizing you personally will never enjoy their shade.
Are there any other questions you want to talk about?
Why don't I talk about that for a second? What's the most satisfying aspect of your role as a leader? The thing I always thought about with that is that's when you see your subordinates advance. When you see somebody go on to greatness, so to speak, you can kind of, once again, just say, well, at least I didn't slow them down. Yeah, you know, they were a person that was clearly going to do good things. And I've been in my own small way, helped them to do that. And again, just coming out of a NATO position, I was very, very proud to see a couple of my people go off to command. And I always told them, because it was a place of a lot of hard work, like, don't forget, you are going to be punished for all your hard work here. The nation send hardworking, smart people to J5. That's where planners go. And you're going to be punished for all this good work. And I was very happy to see a few of them getting punished for their hard work, going off to command, because I was like, that is exactly what I was hoping they would get. And equally, I was also very, very happy that I was able to get a bunch of commendations or awards for several of my people. And again, not me. If they hadn't done their great work, I wouldn't be able to write it up. And fortunately, I have somewhat of a capability in English, and just simply write up and say, this is the awesomeness that they did. Here, they deserve something. more often than not, they got it. It just because it they sold themselves by their accomplishments. And I think the last one, and I get with a cool quote of this, is basically credibility buys access. I was very happy as I did my handover and went up to NATO headquarters up in Brussels. And I was really hoping to get into a couple of offices to say, this is an important person. You should just know who they are. And access was granted because basically the team I led had pushed a lot of very important things forward. And there was a bunch of people, important people up in Brussels that were very happy to sit and meet my successor. And I was able to say, listen, this is an important person. You're going to see them on the VTC or in different very important meetings. And this is who they are. And please work with them. And I think, again, that was just, I was very, that was success to me. I was really happy to see my subordinates move on and be more awesome. And I hope I see them in NATO someday. But equally, just the idea that you could kind of pave the road for your successor a little bit more, rather than your successor kind of falling into the hole you dug for them, they were standing on your shoulders ready to go to the next level.
I'd like to thank Brigadier General Greg Smith for taking the time to talk with me about leadership and leading at an institutional level. His experiences are really so strong, and he has such a strong background to be able to speak from a multinational staff and command perspective. I feel really fortunate that he was able to make the time to share his thoughts with us. I hope his passion for professional military education is really apparent and really laudable. So thanks very much, General Smith. I appreciate the time that you've taken. Leadership Beyond the Trenches is hosted and produced by Anne Reifenstein and is a production of Reifenstein ETCS Productions. Music has been provided by Mikhail Hellman under Creative Commons licensing.